The opinions of why they created 480 in three-phase. At the same time, when I came from Europe, for many years, 280 volts was used between the phase and 220 volts per phase. But at the same time, 415 volts was in England, and in some other countries of Europe was 257 whatsoever. So, in order to standardize when the United Union was created, they had to have devices that could have switches working with different voltages for EU. And I assume that the United States was more lucky. I'm not sure how is with Canada, but the more unified voltages are here. Anyhow, that was... so the changing tolerances of previously existing supplies in Europe and EU cost so much money that they actually politically decided that the UK is not going to low down the voltages to Central Europe, and Central Europe is not going to match the Spain and Portugal and Italy. They just make the devices able to work with different voltages that not fail. So then the Chinese had a very much headache when they decided that they want to export to Europe. But I'm not sure how it's in Canada. Maybe you know, and to Chile.
Yeah, Canada works the same way as the United States does. It's 60 hertz, and it's 120 volts a phase.
Okay, so probably this part of the world was more unified in developing electrical systems. Actually, everything started from Edison and Nikola Tesla. So there was less problems to make it somehow applicable to the rest of the world. Thank you very much. And to you.
Okay, Wes. There's loads of great stories about the beginnings of utility electrical power. There was Tesla, who obviously promoted alternating current, along with Westinghouse. And there was good old Thomas Alva Edison, who was absolutely positively sure, because he didn't own any stock in any alternating generators, that direct current was the way to go. He would travel around the country electrocuting things to demonstrate that high-voltage alternating current could kill even an elephant. Because I believe he did kill an elephant on his demonstration. You can imagine what would happen if someone tried to do that these days. But it's part of our history that there was a great conflict among very powerful, very wealthy people of whether our utility supply would be direct current or alternating current.
Okay, I do thank you very much for that question. It wasn't a stupid question. It was a tough question. After everybody else, Dr. Wave, you can handle another question. What neutron come from 7 years old? 7 years old child, the son of the teacher, asked me, what the neutron comes from? Interesting.
Okay. By the way, AC2JET, I have put you on the list, Wesley, and I'm more than willing to discuss with you how neutrons and protons and quarks and gluons do their thing. Getting back to the person who originated the very interesting question, Rich, any other comments?
No, Roy, I think that about covered it. There's still a lot of more questions than answers, but I have a better idea, and it's what you said about designing for the highest voltage needed in a device and then backing off from there, because you certainly can't do it the other way around, or maybe you can with a step-up transformer. But I have a better idea what it's about, Roy. Thanks.
AS2P with a comment.
Yes, please comment.
One of the factors here is what's available in terms of battery power. Now, you're not going to design something for some weird voltage when you can design it for something that fits in the currently existing batteries. So that's a factor. Another factor is finance. There are many circuits out there for various things, not to do with voltage necessarily, where the manufacturers are putting in parts that don't make a whole bunch of sense until you realize they have a whole boatload of 10-ohm resistors. So they put two in series because they don't have any 20s. Back to that.
Okay, yeah. There are a lot of curious engineering designs that have very boring explanations. One of the best that I heard, it could be apocryphal for all I know, is ICOM, although a wonderful radio, I have an ICOM sitting right in front of me today, has a history of a not-so-good microphone preamp circuit. And the story went that ICOM bought a lot of chips for microphone preamp that were not terribly good, but they got them cheap, and they got a lot of them in stock, and it took years and years to get rid of the darn thing. So that was the reason given among some people for why you really had to boost up the microphone input because the preamp circuit was kind of limp. So, yeah, sometimes it's purely economics and supply and demand. And things you don't think about and aren't taught in electrical engineering courses. Okay, I guess we dealt with that. Next on my list is Stefan. What's your question or your comment for tonight, Stefan?
Thanks, Roy. Sorry, I'm on Echo Link. I had to switch, but I have a pretty specific question. I have a couple of old EthKit SB301 and 401, and I opened it up the other day, and there's no VFO or heterodyne oscillator crystals in them. All 12 of them are missing. And when I went to go buy them, they were $30 each. So I was wondering if anybody knows a way for something like a modern equivalent that I could replace them with. Well, you know, a lot of these chips are going bad in old radios. They're coming out of alignment. And when that happens, is there going to be a way to get new crystals for these? That's really my question.
Okay, that's a good question. Unfortunately, my experience with crystals is negligible. I do recall when a major crystal manufacturer went out of business, I think it was about 6 years ago, they're getting fewer and fewer. They're specializing on standard frequencies that they could sell in the millions as opposed to these somewhat more esoteric ones. I assume someone's going to mention antique radio supplies, but anyone out there know a good source for amateur radio type crystals for replacement?
WP2EA Mobile.
Yes, Ed.
First, it's been a long time. Because I remember the SB301 and 401 had built-in VFOs that were pretty high quality. So I'm not sure where the crystals stand. That said, do we know the frequencies and the holders? Because DIGIKEY has a very good supply of crystals, and as long as you know the frequency and the package, we're ahead of the game. Any comments about the package?
Okay, what do you say, Stefan?
Okay, so the crystals in question are the VFO and heterodyne oscillator crystals, not the actual crystals for the filters, but they are in each 6U body. And really, I was wondering if I could put HD49 or, modern crystals in those old bodies, as long as the frequency match. But if you have someone who has a supply of them and they're not $20 to $30 each, if you could just repeat his call sign, I could reach out to him. And that would help me out greatly. But in the future, I'm really trying to figure out a way around having to buy vintage crystals if anybody knows about really how they work and that type of thing.
Okay. Again,
I believe an HD49 is a lot smaller than HD6. You need to have the right package if you want it to plug in. And if you need an HD6, go on the DGC catalog, and they should have exactly what you want. You specify the package you want, the frequency you want. Don't worry about the tolerances and all that. And you should find something for a fairly reasonable price, although you will have to pay shipping, but I believe if it's small enough, send it by USPS, it'll be as little as $5 or $6 shipping. I would investigate looking at DIGI-KEY, and it's fairly easy to navigate their site. Right?
Okay, thank you, Ed. Yeah, as far as I'm aware, the packaging is just a mechanical aspect. These are quartz crystals cut down to resonant frequencies, and as long as you don't screw up the crystal itself, the packaging doesn't really affect it much in one way or the other. But it's just a mechanical aspect of being able to plug it in and have it stay plugged in. That's the most important, to get the case right and such. I assume you haven't had an opportunity to kind of look up the usual suspects who sell these things, or are they also given to charging $30 a crystal?
For 40-year-old equipment, you're wasting your time.
Okay, so DigiKey, the HD6U is pretty much defunct. They don't make them anymore. And vintage ones are pretty much the only way to get them. And a lot of them are out of wax. So I'm going to try and put HD49, modern crystals, in old bodies of cheap crystals I can find. I would disagree on the 40-year-old stuff being a waste of time. I just like to play around with them. I love the way they sound. I love everything about the old tube stuff. But, I'm not doing it to see if I can reach out further. Or, I just like to get the old stuff working. I appreciate any information anybody has on modifying crystals or, it's just not possible to buy them new. And if it's just the form factor and I can find the correct frequencies in modern crystals, I think that's probably the route I'll go. And I appreciate everyone's help on finding more information on this. Back to Ned.
Roy, can I clarify something?
Yeah, please do it.
What I said was a waste of time is trying to go to an amateur radio source, buy crystals that were designed for that radio. The odds of finding that is vanishingly small. But if you know the frequency, and if you have a suitable way of physically, mechanically inserting it onto the board, good to go. If you're willing to do the mechanical work, the hammer in place, weld shut, that's fine, because the crystal element itself is sealed inside and will not be affected by any of this.
Okay,
excellent.
Very
I appreciate
good.
That, and I'm sorry for misconstruing your comment. That's perfect. I'm going to get started on it, and I will update the net next time when I have this issue figured out, if anybody's interested. Thanks, Max.
Okay, very good, Stefan. I wish you good luck, and I hope you do come back and tell us how it worked out. I mean, I've read stories in QSB of how guys who had proper cases, I think, but the frequencies weren't what they needed, so they would break them open and start playing around with toothpaste to abrade the crystal, lower its mass, change its resonant frequency, and they were able to get it to work. So where there's a will, there's a way. I wish you luck, Steph.
I have a comment about that, Roy.
Certainly, Ed.
After World War II, the military released huge numbers of FT-43 crystals, which did have a screw-on cover. So you didn't have to rip them apart. You just unscrew them. And the crystal blank itself, it's about the size of a fingernail and about a 16th of an inch thick. And you'd raise the frequency, like you said, by grinding and using something like toothpaste. I even tried it myself. The problem was, you're not going to make much of a change in frequency. Maybe less than 0.1%, right?
Well, yeah, I mean, obviously, you know, don't go with something that's 5 megahertz in one direction or the other and expect anything. And unfortunately, it probably requires a great deal of work with that toothbrush. But, you know, it amazes me that there are guys out there willing to give it a go. And occasionally, if you're lucky and you have something just a little bit lower than you want it to be, and you got, you know, the enthusiasm required of using a toothbrush on a small sliver of quartz, and who knows, maybe you could get there.
Hi, Roy, I am home, and I'm not sure I'm going to be able to get back on the net. Sorry about that. WV2E, if you clear, back to net.
Okay, Ed, I understand. I thank you for this participation tonight. I always appreciate you being here. So be well, and we'll talk down the line. Well, let us move on to our next person, Kevin. What was your question or your comment or what have you for tonight? Kevin, are you out there? I can't make out my writing, W2 or something or other. Are you out there? Oh, well, I guess Kevin stepped away. Hopefully he'll step back at some point in the future. Next on my list is Wesley with the discussion of neutrons. So, you know, if any of you need to take a little medication before quantum mechanics is mentioned, feel free.
One ham radio question, WS2N.
Okay, we like to go to those first. So, Paul, what's the question?
This is from the ARRL. They sent letters out, and they talked about increasing the baud rate on HF, and they want to bring it up to 2.8 kilohertz. Eventually, they'd like to do it on other bands as well. So I wonder if you read that. I'm trying to figure out what the original rate was. You know, the bandwidth, they want to go to 2.8. What was it before? Couldn't find that in the article or in the letter. They want to do this, I guess, all for digital communication. They feel that it's restricting what hams could do, especially in emergencies. I guess they feel we'd have a better equipment in that case. Wonder if you read that, Roy, back to you.
AC2GS. I didn't read that exact article, but this has been going on with the ARRL for years. So the problem, apparently, is that the FCC rules are really somewhat archaic. The way that they define the amount of information transmission is in the form of what they call symbol rates. And the ARRL wanted them to redefine them in looser terms, in which a lot of types of transmissions will become acceptable. So they're defining them in some forms as bandwidth. As you increase the bandwidth of a transmission, you increase the symbol rate, you increase the rate of information that can be packed into the transmission. So last I heard, they were particularly wanting it to be in terms of bandwidth. So they would kind of say that, okay, on the CW band, instead of just saying it's CW band or giving a symbol rate for CW transmissions to give proper bandwidth. And then if you had different types of modes that could be used in narrow bandwidth, it would fall under the aegis of the ruling. So I think it's more of nomenclature than anything else. They want to discontinue symbol rates for something better suited, like bandwidth and such.
Okay, very good. Yeah, they do say on November 13th that the FCC commissioners unanimously, you know, there's like four or five guys on that commission, voted to amend the amateur radio service rules to replace the baud rate. And, you know, they're talking about the HF bands. We'll see. I'm sure there'll be further letters, notifications that come out in the near future. Very good. Back to you, Roy.
You're welcome, Paul. I think they've been pushing for that for at least 8 years that I'm aware of. It'll kind of open the door to a lot of relatively newer modes of transmission that were kind of getting stuck with symbol rate limitations and such. So I think it's a good move. It's not going to hurt anyone. It's going to help a bunch of people. So I think it's a smart thing. It's just the kind of general legislative inertia, even in the FCC, that delays good ideas a lot longer than necessary. But I think it'll go through. Well, yeah, they said they voted. I'm sure it's going to be a good thing. I don't expect to hear anyone come here in a couple of years and complain that he doesn't like the new way of rating transmission, symbol rate, bandwidth, what have you. Thank you very much, Paul. Anyone else with an amateur radio-related question before we move on to the neutron? Okay, then I guess it's neutrons for everyone. So, Wesley?
Okay. Okay, so some information first, and then we go to the question. So, neutron is an elementary particle. It's one of the three basic particles making atoms. That would be proton, neutron, and electron. But neutron and proton are not true elementary particles. They are composed of extremely small elementary particles called quarks. The neutron is composed of two quark-down quarks, each with one-third elementary charge, and one up quark with two-thirds elementary charge. So then we have neutron doesn't exist as a free. So, but we do have free neutrons that are not incorporated into nucleus when we have radioactive decay. That is present also in neutron stars. That would be subject to our space professional to say more about it. Neutron does not exist in nature, as I said, in the free state, except among the highly energetic particles in cosmic rays. Neutron is neutral. So it can pass through the electrical field. And neutron is hydron. So if we talk about hydrons as a group, there is a fundamental composite subatomic particle made of quarks held together by strong interaction. I'm not going to say too much about it because we're going to get lost. I'm going to just quickly go to the essence of it. So 7 years old, the son of the teacher asked me, where and what from neutron come from? I didn't say it properly, but okay. And I was kind of puzzled, but at the same time, mass can be converted to energy and reverse, so E equal mc squared. So according to Einstein theory, a special relativity, mass can be converted into the energy and vice versa. So we regularly convert mass to the energy. Then the question comes, can you convert I'm not sure, did I overtime?
No, you didn't overtime. Someone doubled with you.
Okay. So mass can be converted to energy. The process inverse to particle annihilation, if I say it properly, annihilation, can be called matter creation. More precisely, we can consider, we are considering here the process obtained under the time reversal of annihilation process. The process is also known as a pair production and can be described as a conversion of light particles, let's say photons, into more massive particles. So the common And where Faraday's case is the where two photons convert into electron positron pair. So the few more words about it is we go to quarks. For the simple language, quarks are like electrons. They are made up of any other particles. You could say they are the ground floor of standard model of particle physics. So now, Dr. Roy, where do electrons come from? And can we create energy, matter from energy? Back to you.
Okay, that's a really deep question. And AC2GS here. Yes. Energy and matter are simply two forms of the same thing. So you could call it mass energy, you call it energy, you can call it mass. They're the same thing. Highly concentrated energy we call matter, mass. Last week or something, 2 weeks ago, we talked about the Big Bang. There was a point in the Big Bang where energies were so high that the symmetry of all fundamental charge and force particles and mass particles were symmetrical and slipped in and out and back and forth all over the place. Now, the big problem with turning regular energy into matter, as you described it, is you're kind of stuck with this antimatter. Because you have to have conservation of charge, and there's a whole bunch of conservation factors that require that when you bang some photons together with enough force and they produce an electron, they also produce the positron. And where are all the positrons? They don't seem to be here anymore. So that's the big question. What is the matter-antimatter asymmetry? And that brings us to much headier stuff. Suffice it to say that theoretical physicists believe that in massive multiple annihilation episodes, there is a slight favoring of matter over antimatter by something ridiculous like 0.00000000003%. But sufficient that in the first few million years after the Big Bang, most of the antimatter was gone, and we were left mostly with a lot of photons. About 98% of the energy of the universe are the initial photons, which are now in the cosmic microwave background. And the rest are in the form of electrons and quarks. Electrons and quarks are the fundamental particles. Neutrons are composite particles made up of quarks, as are protons. Free neutrons can exist, but they are unstable and they decay. Free protons probably will survive the end of the universe. We don't really know how long, how stable they are, but they're very, very stable. So in post-Big Bang energy annihilating into matter. Again, annihilating into matter is where the electrons and the quarks came, and then as the temperature went down, they condensed into protons, neutrons, and electrons, and then atoms, and then molecules, and then planets. Wes?
Okay. So, if we say that we can convert mass to energy, and we can convert energy to mass, the question that I don't know the answer for is why in this particular form the energy was converted to mass. In other words, if we go to the outdated Bohr atom model, which is very easy to understand. It's outdated, but it's for the people who do not know much about it, it's very much communicative. Why the energy, when it was converted to mass, created electrons, neutrons, protons and atoms. Back to you.
Well, the easiest answer is because it's the nature of physics to do that. Things go into equilibrium, and it couldn't all be photons because they were interacting with the soup, and so they settled into the present understanding of fundamental particles, which some of them are stable and some of them make up stable things. And those stable things are protons and neutrons and electrons. And again, that's why you have atoms that can survive for a billion years.
I'm kind of puzzled with your answer. Because of nature of physics, when we have energy and energy converts to mass, is it any mechanism that actually pushes that energy to create that form of mass? Maybe that rephrasing of the question would more rich answer from your perspective.
Okay, well, once again, energy carriers like photons, if they generate mass, can only generate stable mass according to the underlying laws of the universe. And, unfortunately, there are, in space-time, there are supposedly fields. There are electron fields, there are quark fields, and there are excitations of quark fields. If you have another energy source that excites the quark field strongly enough, you effectively cause the energy to turn into a quark. By themselves, they're not stable, but they merge with three other quarks in chromodynamics using the force of the strong nuclear force of gluons, and they become a stable particle. It depends upon, supposedly space-time by its very nature has fields which express themselves as fundamental particles. Why do they express themselves as those fundamental particles? Lots of luck. If you figure out a good answer enough, you too can win a Nobel Prize.
Okay. So we're clarifying something. In other words, once the very basic fundamental particles were created, they had a certain behavior. That behavior of the particles created their association with other particles, and the way that the associated entity reacted made them electrons, made them protons, and made them neutrons. Am I right?
Not exactly, if I'm understanding what you're saying. It's not the interaction of the particles that give them their characteristics. It's the underlying characteristics of the particles themselves. A proton has a positive charge because it has three quarks whose sum charge is 1+. So that's why it has nothing to do with the neutron next to it or the electron circling it. It internally has that type of a charge. So it's not the interactions that give you the characteristics. It's what the fundamental particles impart that gives it the characteristics.
Okay, so another question that came from the father of the child was biology professor. Is it possible that two photon beams created matter or antimatter?
Theoretically, possibly. So the problem is that presently photons don't interact with other photons. You need an intermediary. So if you have some kind of intermediary, then on the surface of that intermediary, the two photons can interact, and if their energy is sufficient to produce a pair of particle-antiparticles, because you have to have conservation of charge, and photons don't have a charge. So you have to have, if you're going to have a positively charged object or a negatively charged object, you're going to need a symmetrical one on the other side. And, there's even conservation of momentum. If that's the reason why when a positron decays, annihilates an electron. You can't have one photon because you need to have some momentum of zero. And so the two photons have to go off at 180 degrees from each other. So there's a lot of conservation rules that have to be followed in Mother Nature.
Okay, in October 2008, the Department of Energy announced that the Center SLAC, National Accelerated Laboratory, which is Stanford Linear Accelerator, were able to achieve mirror from two laser beams. That's interesting. I didn't go further into that paper, but positron production in multiphoton light by light scattering is another material that I found that was actually able to create a pair positron electron from two photons. So we have enough of energetic photons, then we can create the matter. But at the same time, we know from physics that two photons cannot see each other. Back to you.
Well, I don't know the specific thing that you're citing, but I'm sure there was some medium. It was not in a vacuum. Again, because the problem is that so far as I'm aware, you need to have some kind of third party mediating the interaction of the two photons. As you mentioned at one point or another, the photons by themselves cannot interact with each other. So there has to be some kind of intermediary doing it. My guess is that either was a gas or something else going on in that chamber that was acting as the intermediary.
From what I know, to conserve energy, the electric field loses energy when an electron positron pair is created by amount or equal to where is the electron rest mass and is the speed of light. So electric charge is conserved because of electron positron pair in charge. No. So the electric charge conserved because of electron positron pair is charge neutral. Do you agree with that?
Well, I hope so. I said that 3 minutes ago.
Yeah, that's the Schwinger effect. Schwinger, do I say it properly? S-C-H-W-I-N-G-E-R? Or the Schwinger effect. But it's a prediction. I found in Wikipedia right now, just a second ago, that it is a physical phenomenon whereby matter is created by a strong electric field. It is also referred as a Schwinger effect, Schwinger mechanism, or Schwinger pair production. It is a prediction of quantum electrodynamics, QED, in which electron-positron pairs are spontaneously created in the presence of electric fields, thereby causing the decay of electric fields. The effect was originally proposed by Fritz Schauder in 1931. So, interesting is that we have 2023 right now, and a lot of this stuff was already researched not far from ancient MC square, the theory of relativity. So we're talking about 1931, and theory of relativity was announced in 1909, but it was actually assumed to be real in 1924, if I remember correctly. But
AC2GS. The Schwinger effect is a theoretical one. If you look it up, you're not going to see any experimental evidence. It is theoretical, based on equations, so it might turn out to be true. It's a little bit different than the way you phrased it, but I could understand why it would be different. The Schwinger effect suggests that at a particular intensity of electromagnetic field, the actual nature of space-time is distorted, disrupted, what have you, and the photons can actually decay and break down spontaneously into matter-antimatter pairs, not requiring some kind of intermediary. But so far, the physicists that I'm aware of have been unable to generate the intensities high enough to produce the Schwinger effect. So at this point, it is a theoretical idea that might be provable someday, but has yet to be proved.
Okay. So, a photon cannot interact with another photon. What is your comment?
Again, I agree, because I think I said that about 15 minutes ago.
No. We're not talking about statement, we're just why.
No, well, I think 10, 15 minutes ago, I need a stopwatch. Yes, photons can pass right through each other. Photons are bosons. They don't obey the Pauli exclusion laws. You can't stick two electrons in the same place in space and time. It violates the Pauli exclusion rule. Bosons, usually force carriers, can't occupy the same space and time, and they don't generally interact with each other. They just add to each other as far as another intermediary then registers the amplitude or what have you. So you could have laser beams going at right angles to each other, and they don't care. They go their merry way. They don't interact. Photons do not interact with other photons.
Okay, another question. How come photons are considered massless?
Yes, because they travel at the speed of light. You cannot have anything that travels at the speed of light that contains any rest mass. The speed limit of space-time causality is the speed of light. Add a 0.00000000000000001 nanogram to something, and you cannot accelerate it to the speed of light. Effectively, it would require all the energy in the universe, and it would have an infinite mass, which is somewhat absurd. So that's why a photon, which can travel at the speed of light in the vacuum, is massless. So theoretically are gravitons.
Do you remember when was the first experiment about the gravity? That was a few years ago.
I think you are talking about gravitational waves, which is not really exactly the same as gravity. They are distortions in space-time produced by large, massive objects that warp space-time. And if you have a very, very nicely made interferometer, you can detect the ever-so-slight variations in space. I don't think we have a temporal interferometer, so you can't calculate it based on time fluctuations, but space fluctuations. I think you're alluding to gravitational waves.
Okay. A charged particle has an electric field containing electric energy, which itself influences the mass of the particle in the sense that the mass of the particle is higher than it would be for a neutral particle. So, in a sense, one could say the energy affects the mass and vice versa. Wasn't that the first thing Einstein thought about it when he thought about the theory of relativity?
Were you asked to end?
Yes, Paul.
Yeah, wasn't that the LIGO project that Wesley was talking about 5 years ago? 5, 6, maybe a little bit longer, where they had the LIGO set up in the state of Washington, and where's the other one, down in Louisiana somewhere?
Yeah, they're a set of interferometers, and they continue to work. They take them offline occasionally to tweak the settings and such. There are designs for space-based interferometers to be able to detect much lower frequency gravitational waves, and the hope is that they'll be able to pick up the gravitational wave of the Big Bang, a kind of gravitational wave version of the of the microwave background energy.
Yeah, I think that's probably the first, that was the first time that they proved that they could even detect a gravity wave. Yeah. There's a couple of other ones that are working like that too. There's one in Italy, another one in Japan. I don't know how successful they've been, but LIGO is very successful. And the space-based one, eventually they want to have one like a million miles apart. I think there's going to be three in space. They're going to be like a million miles apart from one another. Leslie, is that the one that you were thinking about when you said when the earliest experiment was done on that?
Yes, it is.
Said, okay. Roy, open it.
Okay. So, coming deeper in it, neutrons don't like to exist on their own outside of the nucleus. So the binding energy of the strong force between them and protons in the nucleus keeps them stable. But when out on their own, they undergo beta decay, and after 15 minutes or so, they transform into proton and electron and to neutrino. So my question to our space expert is, how a neutron star exists effectively?
Paul, if you want me to take it, let me know.
Well, yeah, you could probably take it, because it sounds like he wants to know how the neutron star exists. Well, we know they exist. Packed with a lot of stuff. I know it's very heavy. I think one teaspoon is equal to a mountain or something like that. But yeah, go ahead, Roy.
Okay, thank you, Paul. Okay, the fundamental reason why neutron stars exist is the incredible power of gravity. If you have an object that has a lot of mass, it has a lot of gravity, and that gravity is all squeezing at the center of gravity. And what's holding it together as atoms is the Pauli exclusion principle that I mentioned. There is something called electron pressure that pushes against the gravity, squeezing electrons and protons together. But ultimately, if you make a star big enough, heavy enough, the gravitational forces that act on the electrons and the protons are overwhelmed, and they merge together in basically electron capture, and all of the protons are converted into neutrons. The neutrons stay neutrons. And so you have this relatively smaller globe that is made principally of neutrons and nothing much. There's other things kind of flying through, and certainly at the surface things are very strange. And if you increase the mass of a neutron star, surprisingly you think you'd get a bigger neutron star, but you don't. You get about the same size. It's just a lot more massive. And as Paul said, a grain of sand size piece of a neutron star is ridiculously heavy. But the alternative to keep in mind that you need that gravitational force to maintain it. If somehow you were able to tease that grain size piece of material from a neutron star and throw it into space, it would almost immediately explode into normal atoms once again, because with the lack of gravitational force acting upon them, the electrons and protons would disperse away.
Question in one mighty way.
Yes, Hank.
When you get the electrons being stripped off of the molecule so that you end up with the neutrons, don't you get a layer of degenerate matter that is mostly electrons? If you just pulled a little of the neutron star material out, that it wouldn't really explode because you don't have the electrons going with it?
Well, it, in most cases, the resultant neutron star is from the effect of capture of the electrons. So most of the electrons in a neutron star are captured, and through the weak force changes a proton to a neutron and absorbs an electron, and there are neutrinos involved, there are anti-electrons and annihilation. There's a lot of complications at the surface layer of the neutron star, I'll admit. So there's probably a lot of free electrons and a whole bunch of strange things going on. But for the most part, the overwhelming number of the electrons are captured with the proton and turned into neutrons.
Okay, thank you. And on right away.
You're welcome, Hank. Wesley, did I answer your question?
I would say circle. We may say that the life of neutron is 15 minutes, then it's transforming into proton and electron and antineutrino. Then after the 15 minutes, it has to somehow convert itself to more neutrons in order for that neutron star to exist. And that is kind of puzzling me in terms of gravity you mentioned about.
Okay, not quite sure what the question might be. The neutrons and neutron stars do not spontaneously decay into protons. Neutrons decay spontaneously in space, in vacuum. When they interact with other things, they don't necessarily decay. And in the case of a neutron star, they don't decay. Sometimes what happens is either a lot of mass falls in on its gravitational well, or going back to the gravitational waves, another neutron star attracts another neutron star, and the two of them collide. And they either end up as a more massive neutron star and a lot of interesting side products like gold atoms, and that's how sometimes heavy elements are made, or occasionally they turn into black holes, which I think was also documented using the gravitational wave devices in the past 5-6 years.
Well, what I'm saying is lifetime of free neutron is 15 minutes, that's given. So after that, it has to change to something else. And easy way for us, the neutron gun or the neutron source, in our situation would be actually the alpha emitter that is with of, beryllium window. So we are able to create neutrons from alpha source with use of beryllium windows. But in environment of the neutron star, the after 15 minutes, there has to be some form of freezing more neutrons so that the star could exist.
Well, in a word, no. You just kind of started off your sentence with free neutrons decay. Neutrons and neutron stars are not free neutrons. They're something completely different. So, again, the answer, I guess, would be no. In a neutron star, the neutrons that make up the neutron star, unless you do something like collide another neutron star to it, remains neutrons. It's all pretty much, except on the surface where gravitation is a little bit wonky, but certainly through most of the core, it is basically just nothing but neutrons. You have to realize, if you squeeze matter is electrons and protons and neutrons. So if you squeeze them hard enough, you squeeze the electrons into the protons, and you're just left with a lot of very compact neutrons. It doesn't decay.
I don't know how the neutron star is made, That's why I asked the question. What I know is that the mass of the neutron is 1.008 times mass of the proton, so it's heavier. That's why that one grain of neutron star is as heavy as a mountain in here. But I'm going to take the lyrics and read about neutron stars, what we know about it. Now, the last question that I have is, so I was talking to that 7-year-old boy, and his father is a biologist, a professor, and he said, that's what we tried to discuss a long time ago about it. So there was a big bang, there was an energy that exploded, but before that, that energy has to come to each other. And he said, what was before? It has to be some sort of disbalance that created its energy to accumulate at one point. Back to you.
Okay. Number one, the reason why that speck of neutron star is heavy is not because neutrons are heavier than protons, because the amount that they're heavier by is not that much. It's the density. It's that generally atoms in your body in this world is made out of 99.99999% empty space. In neutron stars, that's not the case. The neutrons are packed much more densely. That's why the mass of a small volume of material is so heavy. Getting back to the Big Bang, if you ask a physicist, most likely their answer is going to be there was no other place but that one point, because the Big Bang would suggest that the universe started as a dimensionless point and expanded. So there was no other place for it to be. It was occupying all the space it could occupy. They might talk to you about quantum fluctuations that produced the Big Bang, and they might suggest to you that at least locally in our space-time, space began with the Big Bang. So in terms of our space-time, there was no before. In terms of time in a much more global way outside of our space-time, lots of luck, because nothing's everything is relative, and time and distances are related to whatever reference frame you wish to pick.
I was thinking about it, and I said, actually, you're right. There was nothing before, so that point would be any point. But at some point in time, the fabric of space was disturbed somehow in order for that energy to accumulate, right or wrong?
Well, we don't know. All we know, you see, the trouble is you want to know what happened a fraction of a second before the Big Bang. And really speaking, a physicist, except for the excuse to write a book and sell some and make some money, no one knows. So no one knows what happened before the Big Bang. So all that they can presuppose is at one point they believe that there was a simple dimensionless thing that inflated itself into our universe. And if you prefer not to think in terms of dimensionless points, you got a problem. Because as far as I'm aware, quarks and electrons and positrons are all dimensionless points. You look up the dimension of an electron, it will tell you not what its diameter is, but it will tell you that its diameter is less than the limitations of measurement, which is the best that they can say, rather than it's zero. So, again, I hate to kind of throw all these quantum mechanic things at you, but yes.
Okay, thank you very much for all of this explanation and the discussion. I hope that somebody from the audience have some questions. I'll be glad to hear them and to exchange.
Okay, well, we got a good 4 seconds before the SpaceNet report. Anyone have any comments to make, any questions or answers to offer?
WB2BXO with a comment.
Yes, Frank.
Yeah, as I understand it, just in different words,